Okay, so let's get started. So we agreed by popular vote that we were going to move to what's it called? Chapter 10, which goes through the details of the Seder. And then if we have time next week, we'll go back to 8 and 9. I'm not sure exactly what's happening with this time after Pesach. So I don't know. Maybe we would continue the learning of Pesachim. Maybe we would do something else. Maybe there'll be other class instead. So I'm not sure exactly now what's going to happen. I'll let you know as soon as I know. I'll do some investigation. Or else you'll find out what's going on after Pesach. I think right now, most people are in the stage of like, let me just get to Pesach and then I'll like work out my life post that. So sorry about the uncertainty here, but we're here today, we're here Monday, and we're here on Tuesday. Assuming we don't finish the chapter on Monday, which we might, but I don't think we will. Okay, so let's get going. So I've given you two versions of the Mishnah here. The reason I've done that is because the printed edition of our Mishnah is normally quite accurate as an edition, but sometimes gets the text of the Mishnah extremely wrong. And the chapter of this chapter is a great example where the print edition of our Mishnah is very different from the version you find in manuscripts, in early manuscripts of the Mishnah. So what I have on the other Hebrew-only page is the text of the manuscript called Kaufman, which is known to be the best manuscript of the Mishnah, best in the sense of most likely to represent the original reading, whatever that means. And you're going to see that there most of the time the differences don't make any sense. So for example, if you look here in the print edition, it says Arvei Pesachim, and in the manuscript it says Erev Pesachim. There's no difference between those two things. It's just one says Arvei in the plural, one says Erev in the singular. There's no difference between those two things. We're still talking about Pesach night. Sometimes we'll find that the differences in the Mishnah manuscript make a ton of difference. The reason that this particular chapter is so different compared to the manuscripts is because our printed edition will always match our text of the Haggadah. In other words, like you might read the print edition and think, oh, that's amazing. Our Haggadah text has been identical for 2,000 years. And the answer is no. The print edition has been updated based on the known Haggadah text. So when we see some extracts from the Haggadah, that will be the main place where you'll see major divergences between the print edition and the manuscript. And some of those will be very interesting and some of those will be not very interesting. Okay, but we're going to go through. So I'm going to read from the printed edition from Sepharia, and then I will tell you when things are substantially different, but I'll sort of keep both scrolling as we go. Okay, sounds good? Okay, so we're going to learn some Mishnah. So, Arvei Pesachim, Samuch la Mincha, Lo Yochal Adam Ad Shetechshach. So again, if you remember the structure of the whole of Pesachim is this sort of chronological view. So we did all the things about the Pesach offering, and now we're like in the temple, started talking about how they cook the Pesach, and now we're talking about how they eat it and the circumstances in which they eat it in the Seder. What we're saying is the evening, the day before Pesach on the 14th, Samuch la Mincha, around Mincha time, a person should not eat anything until it gets dark. This is a bit of an ambiguous Mishnah for a bunch of reasons. Firstly, what does it mean, samuch, nearby? Like how nearby? That could be a whole bunch of things, like half an hour, 2 minutes. Like what does samuch mean? Mincha also is ambiguous. There are actually two times which are called mincha time. There's the earliest time you could bring the afternoon tamid, the regular offering, or the latest time. So we don't know whether it's the earlier mincha, which is around 12:30, or the later mincha, which is around 3:30. So that's pretty ambiguous. The Talmud tries to narrow down on this, they end up with samuch meaning about half an hour, and the mincha being the later mincha, which means from about 3 p.m. You shouldn't eat until it gets dark. And what's the point of not eating until it gets dark? Seems similar to, like you're supposed to enter into the Seder with an appetite. That's the thing they're trying to get to you, which is that you should be excited about the matzah and the various other mitzvah food that we're going to talk about as we go through. So like, you know, you're spending the whole day preparing for Pesach. So you're like, want to be excited about the Seder. You want to have that first taste of matzah to be delicious. So you want to make sure that you don't eat in the afternoon. This is also the first, the Mishnah doesn't know about the fast of the firstborn. It doesn't, the Mishnah doesn't have that fast. This is the first inkling of that fast, in the sense, which is like everybody shouldn't eat in the afternoon before Seder night, which later turned into, and also firstborns should fast on the day, on the entire day. That was just a later development from the Mishnah. The Mishnah doesn't know about that fast. Okay. Now, so this is sort of setting the tone for what the evening should look like. So number one, you should enter into it hungry. Vafilu anisha b'Yisrael lo yochal ad sheyasev. Even a poor person, the poorest, a poor person in Israel, a poor Jew, shouldn't eat until they recline. Reclining, we all know that's a major part of Pesach. Reclining is, for the Mishnah, not at all remarkable for Pesach. Reclining is just what you do at fancy meals. It just, the word, you know, yesev here, just means you have to have a fancy meal, which involves reclining, and then like servants bring you stuff, and you're like lying on a couch or something. Sounds nice. So the point, the emphasis here is everyone should have a fancy meal, even poor people of Israel, even the poorest of Jews. Everyone should try to have a fancy meal on Pesach. That's the goal. Okay, and then another requirement here. V'lo yifratu lo me'arba kosot shel yayin v'afilu min hatam chui. You should not, they shouldn't have less than 4 cups of wine. Anybody, like including the poorest people, should have no less than 4 cups of wine, even if you have to get it from the tamchui, the collection plate. You have to get it from charity funds. Now, the tamchui could be referring to just the wine, or it could be referring to the entire meal, right? Like, my guess is it refers to the entire meal. Like, even if you have to get the money from tzedakah funds, you should still do so in order to have your fancy meal with 4 cups of wine. On Pesach. Okay. The other key thing about the Mishnah is, we're going to see this as we go through it, so I'll prove this to you if this claim seems outlandish at first, but you'll see me prove it as I go through, which is that the Mishnah doesn't think that the 4 cups of wine are some kind of like dramatic ritual requirement. They're just describing how many cups of wine you should have at this extra fancy meal. In other words, if you were to translate this requirement of 4 cups of wine from the Mishnah's world into our world, it would basically be like, make sure there is a bottle of wine at your table. Like, it has to be a high-end meal. And you'll see, because the Mishnah would assume that you already have 3 cups of wine for any fancy meal. And so the only unique one for the Seder is the fourth, which we're going to see as we go through. Okay, so that's the way the Mishnah thinks about it. By later rabbinic texts, obviously the 4 cups of wine become a ritualized central part of the Seder. Also, the same process happens with the reclining, right? The reclining here is just like a way of talking about having a fancy meal, but now reclining is like an essential ritual aspect of the Seder that we do to show our freedom. Again, like the same kind of process happened there, which is that a thing which was sort of not particularly ritually meaningful got imbued with ritual meaning over time. Okay. Let's move along. Okay, so there are two subjects in this chapter. There's the plural subject, which are the servants. We talked about the servants before. There were waiters involved in the previous, in chapter 7. Yeah, and I think I said that it was likely that they were Jews. They could be Jews. They could also be non-Jews. Having thought about it a little more, it's possible that when the Mishnah in chapter 7 said that the waiter has to sort of go back to their chavura, to their group, doesn't necessarily mean that they have to be a registered Jew for that Paschal offering. It could mean that their master is a registered Jew for that Paschal offering. So therefore, like the waiter there could in fact be a non-Jew. So I'm not sure exactly who these servants are, but there are certainly people who are serving the meal. That's the plural subject here. And then there's a singular male subject or a singular or object who is the father, the leader of the Seder in some way. So no, that's the point. If it was a non-Jew, then just their master would have to be circumcised. They wouldn't eat of the Pesach. They just have to be with the group that their master is registered for, rather than they have to be with their own Pesach group. So anyway, but I think either is open. I actually don't know whether they're Jews or non-Jews. Yes, that's true. It did refer to eating. It's true. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. It's hard. I don't know. If they're non-Jew, could they touch the wine? Yes, a slave, non-Jewish slave. If you have a non-Jewish slave, for sure they can touch the wine. Non-Jewish slaves are Jews in some ways. And if they become freed, they become totally Jews. Okay. Here we go. Mazgulo kosrishon. So they mix for him a first cup of wine. So the mixing refers to, I think we mentioned this before, their wine came in sort of syrup that you have to mix with water in order to drink in a pleasant fashion. So the servants in some way were having a guest appearance in the background by my two-year-old, who's screaming. So there you go. as you do when you're two. So the servants bring out the first cup and bring it to the leader of the Seder or the participants in the Seder. And there's a debate about an aspect of this. Beit Shammai Omrim, Mevarech al Hayom, Ba'achar Kach Mevarech al Hayayin. There are two blessings you have to do on this first cup of wine. The first one is on the day, which is essentially Kiddush, right? Which is Mekadesh Yisrael V'Hazmanim, the bracha that we know as that, which sort of brings in the day of Yom Tov. And then there's also Bri Pri Hagafen, you have to say, obviously, over drinking the wine. So Beit Shammai think that you should bless, you should do Kiddush first, and then Borei Pri Hagafen afterwards. You should say Mekadesh Yisrael V'Hazmanim, and then Borei Pri Hagafen. They seem to think that the core reason we're having wine is because of the day. So therefore, the day is what we're really focused on, and sort of the wine sort of comes along for the ride, rather than Beit Hillel, who will say it the other way around. Beit Hillel Omrim Mevarech Al Hayayin, V'Achar Kach Mevarech Al Hayom. Beit Hillel say that you should bless on the wine first, and then afterwards you should bless, you should do Kiddush on the day. So in other words, they're like, well, you have to drink the wine, so the wine is clearly the focus, and the Kiddush sort of comes along for the ride with the wine that you're drinking. This is obviously the practice that Beit Hillel win the day, as they often do, most of the time do. We do, in fact, say Bri Pri Hagafen halfway through Kiddush, and then Mekadesh Yisrael V'Hazmanim at the end. But the key point about this debate is that this would apply, this is not a specifically Seder night debate. This would apply on any day where you had Kiddush and a fancy meal with wine. So that would apply on Shabbat and any other Yom Tov, that you would, they would have this exact same debate. So this is not specifically about Pesach. This is your first cup. You would naturally have a first cup with your appetizer course. This first cup comes with the appetizer course and also has Kiddush along with it. This is also the case, by the way, that the Kiddush can be separated from the wine, because we say the blessing Mekadesh HaShabbat or Mekadesh Yisrael V'Hazmanim, we say it in the Amidah, at Shul, without any wine. So for us, it's certainly true, like the way this fell out, is that the wine can be separated from the Kiddush, and that's why Beit Hillel's framework wins here, which is like, yeah, you got to bless some wine, you got to drink the wine, so you got to bless the wine. And then you also got to do Kiddush. You may as well do that with your wine glass, but it's not like the wine is central to the blessing of Kiddush. You can say Kiddush without wine, you do it in Shul. Okay, so that's the first cup. We're sort of getting into our appetizer course, which is about to be right here. So we just had the step Kadesh in the Seder. Okay, Heviu Lefanav. They bring before him. So again, the servants bring before the leader, the set or the participant. Maybe they doesn't say exactly what they bring before him, but it seems like they bring the appetizer plate. Matabel bechazeret ad shimagia lafaret hapat. They dip, right? The participants dip with lettuce chazeret, their maror. And their lettuce was probably much more bitter than ours. We have bred out the bitterness over centuries of selective breeding of lettuce. I think Ashkenazim were like, what do you mean lettuce is not bitter enough to really feel the bitterness of slavery, so we have to have something stronger like horseradish. But for them, their lettuce was probably quite bitter. So for them, the chazeret is the same as the maror. But this is not the mandated mitzvah maror, it seems. This seems to be just the normal appetizer course, which is that they ate like Middle Easterners. They had dips, like they probably didn't have hummus, but let's imagine it's hummus. Would take the normal meals would be you'd have some dips, you'd have some vegetables, you'd dip the vegetables into the dips, and that would be your appetizer course. And then you in the main meal you would take bread and dip that into your dips and have that as the main part of your meal. So this seems to be the normal appetizer course. The chazeret here is not particularly associated with a seder. This is the normal chazeret you would eat at a fancy meal. Then, heviu lefanav matzah v'chazeret. Oh, sorry, al shemegi lefaharet apat. Paharet apat is sort of like the appetizer course. So you're sort of like, the guests are sort of dipping in a little bit until I get to the full appetizer course. So this is karpas, the step in the seder karpas. And indeed, yes, latim v'lachamet, exactly. And indeed, you could eat appetizers from karpas. That is totally fine if you're excited to do that in your seder. If you get too hungry by the time you get to Magid, you can certainly start eating appetizers at karpas, as long as you don't eat the mitzvah foods yet. Okay. Then, heviu lefanav matzah v'chazeret v'charoset u'shnei tavshilin. Okay. Afal pi she'ein charoset mitzvah. So now you bring before a plate which we would call the seder plate in some form, which is the matzah and the mandated mitzvah maror, and the charoset, which is some kind of dip, and two cooked dishes. The two cooked dishes on our seder plate are the zroa and the beitza, the shank bone and the egg, the roasted egg. But if you look over here in the manuscript, there is no mention of two cooked dishes. There's no shnei tavshilin in the earlier text of the Mishnah. Oh yeah, so the way they ate also is that everyone had sort of personal tables, so that nothing was out, there was no like big table for everything to be out on already. Everything was sort of in the kitchen, you'd have to bring it out and put it on your personal table, and at the end of every course you would sort of take away the table, you know, wipe it off and then bring it back or something. So yeah, they did not have the same table on the table beforehand, for sure. Okay. So this is a later insertion because we know that we have to have the beitza and the zroa on the seder plate. So somebody added these words, shnei tavshilin, which sort of comes via the Talmud. The other reasoning for the zroa and the beitza, which we already spoke about, is that the zroa represents the Pesach offering and the beitza represents the Chagigah offering. And in fact, I found it impossible in my locale to find any zroa, any shank bones to use for this. It turns out there's lots of other things you can use, including, and for the beitza as well, lots of things you can do, because I also couldn't find eggs. But we do have some eggs, but we couldn't find like mandated, you know, large amount of eggs you need for Pesach. I remember my mother once did an online order for 12 dozen eggs for the Pesach baking, and they had to call her up and say, did you mean 12 eggs or 12 dozen eggs? And she was like, no, I meant 12 dozen eggs. So there's a bunch of things you can use. We're probably going to end up using a little bit of roasted meat instead of the zroa. But you could also use like a chicken bone or something like that. But yeah, okay. So an acceptable shank bone. So presumably it has to be a kosher animal. Presumably it has to be there has to be a little bit of meat on the bone. That's probably fine. But as I said, there are many things you could use instead. It's a very flexible requirement. Okay, and they also clarify that afal pi she'ein charoset mitzvah. The charoset, the dip, exactly. There are lots of things that one can use. Afal pi she'ein charoset mitzvah, and they clarify that the charoset is not one of the mandated mitzvah foods. This tells you, by the way, that forget about that. Not one of the mandated mitzvah foods, or alternatively, another way you can read, sometimes mitzvah in the Mishnah doesn't mean mandated or required or commanded, it means ideal. So it may be that you'll see in a second, Rabbi Elazar, so this should be Rabbi Elazar, his name is not Rabbi Eliezer, his name is Rabbi Elazar, so it's a mistake in the print edition. If you look over here in the manuscript, he has Lazar, which is just Elazar, just different spelling, they just drop the Aleph at the beginning. Rabbi Elazar bar Rabbi Tzadok Omer, mitzvah. Actually, he thinks it's ideal. You should have the charoset there. The dip is a major important part of the mitzvah activity, as opposed to the majority opinion, which seems to think that you bring the dip because you need the dip, but it's not a central part of the mitzvah. which is true. It's not an essential part of the Mishnah. If you can't make haraset, you don't need haraset. Okay. And then, uva mikdash hayu mevi'in lefanav gufo shel Pesach. In the temple, they would bring before him the body of the Pesach. Now, a lot has been made by readers of this text by this hayu. Right? In other words, they used to do this, but now they don't. A lot has been made about that. If you look in the manuscripts, the word hayu is missing. So what difference does it make? The difference it makes is when you think the Mishnah is set. Do you think the Mishnah is describing a contemporary ritual or a temple times ritual? The way our printed edition looks, it sounds like they're talking about their current Seder, and in the past, the temple ceremony was slightly different, whereas in the manuscript, they seem to be talking about temple times. There would be a Seder at home in temple times, just as there would be a Seder in non-temple times. The only difference is they would have the Gufo Shel Pesach, the actual body of the Pesach lamb. So yeah, this is a big argument about how to read the Mishnah's mission here. Are they trying to create a new ritual that has sort of never been seen before? Or are they essentially just continuing a ritual, a home ritual that has always been happening around Pesach? I'm on the latter camp, but many people are on the former camp. So that's just a way, it's always hard to know when the Mishnah is imagining that it's set. Are they imagining contemporary institutions, or are they imagining a temple setting? Sometimes your ideological read of what the Mishnah is trying to do will depend on your predilections about whether you think that they're describing a contemporary practice or an old practice. Okay, we'll do a little bit of Mishnah 4, but we're not going to finish it because it's quite long. Yes. Okay. Well, we can talk about this. Maybe this will take us the rest of time. Talking about the temple being rebuilt, it's hard for us to imagine now how much they literally thought the temple was going to be rebuilt, like really soon, like actually was going to be rebuilt, like actually like any day. It's hard for us to imagine that sense, because it's just been so long for us. And in fact, the temple actually was nearly rebuilt, in the fourth century. The Emperor Julian agreed to rebuild the temple. He died or something went wrong in the plan and it sort of fell apart. But it nearly happened in the fourth century. So the immediacy of the temple coming back for them was, very real. So the best interest. So this is another way of how people read the Mishnah. People are very interested in reading the Mishnah as a political power play of rabbis versus priests of the rabbis are trying to assert their own authority over the old authority of the priests. It seems to me that the priests always had authority from temple times, post-temple times. They were always valued members of their communities. They always had special posts in their synagogues. That's they had important roles to play. They always had authority. They never lost the authority. I'm sometimes suspicious of those kind of power dynamic readings. Because sometimes people don't say things because it gets them power. Sometimes people say things because they think it's true. So it's hard to know. How do you know when they're saying something because they think that this sort of gets them the most power, or because they are, just thought it was right, regardless of who wins out. So that's a longer thing we could talk about. I think both the manuscripts and the print edition say the same thing about Haroset, the majority opinion is that Haroset is not required. Only Rabbi Lazar or Rabbi Tzadok thinks it is. Okay, let's do a little bit. So am I. A little bit more of this Mishnah. Okay, Mazgulo Kos Sheni. So now we're onto the second cup. V'chan haben shoel aviv. Okay, the son asks his father. The manuscript is slightly different here. Mazgulo kosheni v'chein haben shoel, and so the son asks. Doesn't exactly say who he asks here. But it seems the point of this is, right, there are four places in the Torah where it talks about what you should say to your children about the Exodus. Those four places become the four sons midrash in our Haggadah. Each of the four places is assigned a personality on the son, based on the son. This just seems to be, now we're getting to the story part. Now we're getting to the part where you need to be talking to your children, where they can like ask questions about the Exodus and what's going on in the Seder, etc. Like this is now the time where the story seems to happen. Okay. So the second cup goes with the Magid, with the telling of the story, and also therefore the meal. We'll see that the meal has to be around here, as we'll see. Because firstly they start talking about the meal, we're about to get the Manishtana, and also the next cup is Birkat HaMazon, which means the meal had to have happened in between. So this is the second cup goes with the meal. It seems to be the main meal wine that you would drink to sort of aid digestion, and it comes with the story. I'm going to point out one other crazy thing in the manuscript, which it says here in the print edition, it says, Im ein da'at babein, aviv melamado. If the son doesn't know anything, if the son doesn't have da'at, knowledge, or intention sometimes, or like sort of higher level thinking, then the father teaches him. The manuscript actually says, Im da'at babein, aviv malamdo. If there is knowledge in the son, the father teaches him. And the word ein is added in a margin. So somebody saw the text im da'at bevein and added the word ein, thought the text was wrong and added this extra word. Now it seems to me these are actually very different models of pedagogy and the Seder, right? One of them is ensuring everyone has the base level of knowledge, right? If people don't know anything, you have to explain to them what's going on in the Seder. Versus this one is sort of a differentiation model in the manuscripts, which is like, if they have ability to retain all this information, you should teach them all the amazing things you know about Pesach, right? Which is like a, right, exactly. So this is two different ways of thinking about the pedagogical aim of the Seder. Are we trying to ensure a minimum standard of knowledge for everyone attending, or are we trying to ensure let's sort of stretch the people at the top? So it seems to me that this difference, I've seen many scholars argue that this is just that the real text of the Mishnah is always ein da'at bevein. It's just a mistake, but I think actually this is it represents a really different kind of vision as to what the Seder is about, what the goal of the educational purpose of the Seder is about. So next time we'll pick up here and we'll on Monday, and we'll start with the Manishtana, and there's lots of fun, exciting differences to get to about the Manishtana. Okay, thank you. Shabbat Shalom, everyone.